It's hard to say. I remember at a young age I was trying to make things up. But, you know, in terms of composing more complex material, I think some of it came, perhaps in high school, because I would listen to a lot of bands like Tool and some heavier bands that did actually incorporate a lot of odd time signatures and overlapping polyrhythms, you know? And that was a big influence.
Herzlich willkommen und danke fürs Einschalten hier beim Elbphilharmonie Talk. Wir sind Julika und Tom, und Tom ist ja jetzt eine völlig neue Situation, weil ich dieses Mal tatsächlich einfach direkt im Anschluss an dein Gespräch mit Linda Mahan-Oh hier in das Setting reinplatzen durfte für unsere gemeinsame Anmoderation.
Genau, steht sogar noch das Glas Wasser von Linda Mahan-Oh, das unberührte Glas Wasser von ihr.
Oh wow, das heißt, ich kann es berühren.
Du könntest es theoretisch berühren.
Sie ist Jazz-Bassistin und hat bei uns das Auftaktkonzert gegeben für die Jazz-Bass-Reihe, die wir dieses Jahr Saison 25/26 in der Elbphilharmonie veranstalten. Du warst auch in ihrem Konzert, richtig, gestern?
Ja, ich war in ihrem Konzert und war, ich fand es ausgesprochen imponierend, wie sie ihre Band führt. Sie spielt in einem Quintett. Ich fand die Musik sehr demanding. Also wirklich, also wenn man jetzt etwas harsch sagen würde, es ist eine anstrengende Musik. Es ist jetzt nicht so, dass die da so nett vor sich hinswingt und man das Gefühl hat, ah, die spielen aber schön zusammen, sondern man muss unheimlich aufpassen, man muss sehr präsent sein. Es passiert unheimlich viel zur gleichen Zeit, sehr komplexe Dinge. Die Melodien, von denen sie sehr viele hat, sind jetzt nicht so, dass man denkt, ah ja, das ist irgendwie Gassenhauer von morgen, sondern das ist schon alles sehr, sehr komplexes Material, mit dem sie da gekommen ist. Das war wirklich stark.
Für dich ist diese Reihe wahrscheinlich ein Programm-Highlight, ne? Du bist ja selber, hast Kontrabass studiert,
ja,
Jazz-Fan, werden da Träume wahr?
Ja, da werden Träume wahr. Da werden vor allem Träume wahr, weil Michel Nidigio-Cello kommt, die ich seit Jahrzehnten toll finde, weil Henri Texier kommt, der französische Kontrabassist, der irgendwie zu meinen Hausgöttern zählt seit auch sehr, sehr langer Zeit. Christian McBride haben wir öfter hier gehabt. Das ist toll, den zu hören. Und der spielt, ich habe mit Linda May, nachdem wir das Recording-Ding da ausgeschaltet hatten, noch gesagt, ja, keiner spielt so wie Christian McBride. Es ist einfach
ungerecht. Der kommt auf Einladung von Brett Mehldau im
März.
Genau,
der kommt, ist aber sozusagen, er beschließt diese Reihe. Und das ist eigentlich kein Band-Leader in dem, sondern die sind einfach ein Duo. Aber er spielt halt viehisch gut. Und dann ist eben Lisa Wolf, und Linda May hatte von Lisa gehört und freute sich, dass da irgendwie ein Local Hero auch dabei ist in der Reihe.
Lisa Wolf, eben Hamburger Kontrabassistin.
Hamburger Kontrabassistin und ja legendäre Bespielerin des großen Saals, ganz am Anfang von Corona, da unvergessen. Und jetzt kann sie endlich mit ihrer eigenen Band, mit einem neuen Quintett kommen.
Aber bevor wir jetzt über alle anderen Bassistinnen sprechen, wie war denn euer Gespräch?
Es war toll. Es war vor allem unheimlich interessant, weil sie hat einen 4-jährigen Sohn und Nilo. Und Nilo ist auf Tour dabei. Und Nilo hatte dann auch beschlossen, dass er jetzt hier auch dabei sein wollte. Und wie das mit 4-jährigen ist, man kann die jetzt nicht so zähmen, dass sie still im Eckchen hocken
das
die ganze
heißt,
Zeit.
Das heißt, er hat es auch in den Elbphilharmonie Talk geschafft.
Er hat es in den Elbphilharmonie Talk geschafft, und ich habe zum ersten Mal einen Elbphilharmonie Talk mit einer Künstlerin geführt, die ihr Kind dabei hatte. Und das war erstaunlich, weil sie war total geduldig und wunderbar und sweet mit ihm und war jederzeit bereit, das Gespräch zu unterbrechen, um ihm sein Video wieder einzustellen. Das aber noch viel erstaunlicher war, dass sie dann zurückkehrte ins Gespräch, als wenn sie es nicht unterbrochen gehabt hätte.
Wow.
Also total, der Mind ist, das merkt man, also diese Frau ist unfassbar mental orientiert und strukturiert und wirklich bewundernswert einfach.
Und worum ging es so? Habt ihr auch über das Konzert gesprochen?
Wir haben über das Konzert gesprochen, weil sie spielt bei Pat Metheny in der Band, sie spielt mit ganz vielen wirklich auch extrem angesagten Leuten wie Jay Iyer, Ambrose Akin Musiri, der Trompeter, und Tyshawn Sorey, selber ein fantastischer Komponist und Schlagzeuger, die alle hier ja auch schon wiederholt gespielt haben. Und sie ist einfach wirklich die totale Oberliga. Und so zu hören, wie ist das Wechselspiel von ich bin die Bandleaderin und ich bin jetzt hier bei Pat Metheny, wie groß ist der Unterschied eigentlich im Jazz zwischen Führen und Folgen, wenn man es mal auf eine etwas abstraktere Ebene bringen will. Das war sehr erhellend, wie sie darauf geantwortet hat. Und wir haben natürlich auch ein bisschen über ihre Jugend gesprochen, über ihre Kindheit. Ich habe irgendwo gehört und gelesen, dass sie in einer Garage-Band gespielt hat.
Sie kommt aus Australien, richtig?
Genau, sie ist in Malaysia geboren, Kind chinesischer Einwanderer. Und auch das spielt ein bisschen eine Rolle, ob dieses Work-Ethos, was sie so hat, diese Arbeitshaltung, wirklich alles 200%ig zu machen, ob das irgendwie auch so ein bisschen aus dieser aus dieser chinesischen Mentalität, so ungenau das sein mag, aber ob das da irgendwie auch einen Einfluss gehabt hat und so. Darüber haben wir gesprochen, dann eben über ihre Garageband und ihre Liebe zu Metallica und es war ganz schön.
Ach schön. Ja, ich freue mich sehr auf das Gespräch, das zu hören und natürlich auf alle weiteren Basskonzerte, die da kommen.
Unbedingt, die Basskonzerte müssen alle gehört werden.
Und damit auch euch viel Spaß beim Hören.
Elbphilharmonie Talk, der Gesprächspodcast der Elbphilharmonie.
So, good morning, dear Linda. So, we are sitting together here. Linda Mahan, double bass player from the United States of America, meanwhile. Mm-hmm. Born in Malaysia, raised in Australia, moved to the US, like in the mid... 2000s.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, very good to have you here. We are sitting in the dressing room of Elbphilharmonie, kleiner Saal. You happen to have used this room just a good 12 hours ago because you have been performing in this hall with your quintet. It was quite an impressive evening, I must say.
Oh, thank you.
And I'm curious to hear, how did you feel on stage? How did you feel with the audience? How did you feel with the overall situation?
Yeah, I mean, it's such a privilege to play in such a beautiful space. It is gorgeous. The technical team is amazing and the sound was really great to work with.
This, by the way, is Nilo. Nilo might every now and then come in, you know, it's the four-year-old boy of Linda's and of Fabian's, her pianists. And this is funny because I was, of course, having this on my list, one of the questions. I know you have a child, 4 years, meanwhile. How do you deal with him when you are on tour? And the answer is like vividly sitting here next to us and he's watching a movie whilst we are conversing.
Yeah.
So... But I think it's a strain for you, you know, somehow to balance the motherhood and being totally responsible for him and then being totally responsible for your band and for the needs like doing podcasts and stuff. How do you balance that?
Yeah, it's definitely a delicate balance. I'm so grateful, though, to be able to have a fantastic pianist in my band who's also my husband. So we do a lot of tag teaming. We have so many beautiful connections around the world as part of this beautiful music community. I don't hear it, Baba. So we have a beautiful community of people around the world that help, you know, whenever we need babysitters. I think a lot of has changed over the years too, in terms of gender equity and the fact that, you know, I think the only way we can make this work is sometimes if we take him on the road, you know, and especially when he was a baby and I was breastfeeding, you know, it was just, I couldn't play unless I took him. And I'm thankful for a lot of beautiful people, a lot of great promoters who have made it possible for this to happen, you know. And I definitely am inspired by people who came before me, people like Jerry Allen, the wonderful pianist and mother of three, who you can see pictures of her sound checking with her baby on her back, you know.
Beautiful, yeah.
So, yeah, I'm grateful for the people around me in the community and just grateful that people can allow this to happen and we can make music, make art and still be parents. And yeah, I'm grateful.
Did you make any longer pause after you gave birth?
There was a slight pause because my son was born during COVID, during the height of the pandemic, and we were in Australia where they had shut the borders, actually. And so just when he was born and the first 9 months, we had a brief pause, but we were actually still playing in Australia, in Perth. And then right afterwards, we went on a four-week tour. I had a residency in Finland, and then I was touring with Vijay Iyer's trio, with Taishan Sori, and with my group as well. So we had a bit of help from Grandma, and we just had to plan it in a way that I could still be with my son, breastfeed, and have my son with me. And it was hectic, but a really beautiful experience.
Now, if you are home in Harlem in New York, is there any family around you?
There was no family. We split our time between Harlem in New York and also Boston, Cambridge, very close to Boston, because I teach at Berklee College of Music and my husband is doing his PhD at Harvard. Mm-hmm. So there we've moved Fabian's parents up closer to us. So
that's
Yeah.
Handy, coming in handy.
Absolutely handy, yeah.
Next question, maybe it's a very male question, but I think it's also interesting for women. They have the actual experience. Did the playing, the making of music with the bass make any difference for you after having given birth, after the pregnancy? Did it change your physical approach to the instrument and ultimately the resulting music that you make?
Yeah, so there were a few changes. I think after childbirth, your body changes, you know, especially with the holding the baby and breastfeeding for hours, your wrists have to really become strong, or they, you know, initially it was hard to even open jars, you know, but I managed to get the strength back, and yeah, it just took some time, you know, but you know, one thing I'd say is that I think it gives a bit of perspective of just what can you do, how can you adjust. So sometimes it meant playing a little less and just, I guess, conserving your energy a little bit, but also just, I think some of the music making did change a little bit in terms of just how I was expressing myself, I think, you know, and...
Yeah, that's what interests me most, of course. I mean, you know, the internal process of being a mother, being in the lineage of... You know, having been a daughter and still being a daughter and now giving birth and being a mother and this cycle of life situation, you know, that changes so much in the perception of life. And
definitely. And I think priorities change. And also I do think that the music I've written in the last 5 years, I would say, has a lot to do with my perspective on the world, you know, and the world that we're bringing up our future generations in. And so, a lot of the songs that I've written have been about that, you know, the last album, Strange Heavens, about living your life, searching for something that's not settling for a familiar hell and searching for a strange heaven. And I believe that, you know, I think we should definitely appreciate all the things that we have, but we can have the perspective that if things need changing for the better, you know, what can we do together as a community to make that happen, you know? Mm-hmm. And I believe that politically. I believe that, you know, when you vote, when you go to the ballot and vote for politicians, I believe that with just your day-to-day life, when you make those decisions day-to-day, you know? And I think... I just had a premiere of a commission with the wonderful Pamela Z, an electronic musician and vocalist, and we had some beautiful visual artwork from Keith Henry Brown, and the whole project was called Invisible Threads, and it's about the invisible threads that connect us as humans, you know, and sometimes unbeknownst to us, you know. Part of that was attributed to my mother. I connected the idea of threads with sewing, with tying people together, and she is an incredibly tenacious person. And I think, yeah, that idea of now being the mother myself, you know, it definitely has really struck me in a very personal way, and it affects the way that I write music and perform music. It's very personal and dear to me, you know.
Beautiful. And I bet some of that tenacity of your mother's, you've definitely inherited that, because, I mean, the way you approach the instrument, the way you approach the composing part, which is a large part of what you do, I would say, is very tenacious in a way, because, you know, you... it's a very muscular and visceral and difficult music that you are composing. Even the, I mean, you performed this beautiful solo piece yesterday where we would just accompany yourself with kind of a bourdon on the bass and, of course, then do some other stuff on the bass and singing. And even the singing, even though it was inspired by your young boy, wasn't a lullaby as such, I would say.
Yeah.
So I would be utterly unable to sing that, you know, after having heard it. So somehow this does not have changed, I feel, you know, it's still the same energy of really maximize the effort in making music.
Absolutely. And I think as a musician, I feel incredibly privileged, you know. Hi, my love.
This isn't the one with the sun.
Okay, it'll come. Sorry. So I think I feel very privileged to be able to make music for a living. There are incredible people all around the world doing incredibly great things for everyone around this planet. I think about doctors. I think about people in war zones. I think about human rights activists and lawyers and And I feel like if I'm making music for a living and performing in front of people, I want to make it the most sincere process that I possibly can. And I want to work my hardest in order to bring the message that I want to get across as I possibly can. You know, it's a dear privilege, and I'm so grateful for the supporters of music, especially music that's a little more left of center, that's not mainstream, that involves improvisation, you know. Yes, my love. Yeah, so I feel incredibly privileged to be able to play music and create art, so I want to put in my 100% and be as sincere as I possibly can be.
Is this a work ethos that's maybe also coming, you know, this is maybe trivial to say that, but this is like a Chinese way of approaching, you know, in your system. If I do something and if I... And then again, of course, the whole story about the women in the business, they still have to be 200% mm. better than the men, and all this annoying patriarchy stuff. Does that play out in your...
I do think so. I think that's influenced the way that I've become an artist, in the fact that definitely as I was coming along, there was this feeling that I didn't want people to just assume that I couldn't play, that I couldn't handle this music.
Master the instrument.
Exactly.
The way you do. Yeah.
Exactly. And it makes you want to work extra hard, you know? And as I've gotten older, I feel like I'm grateful to have been through the experiences that I have, but I can also step back and relax a little, in the sense that I don't have to prove myself as much, you know? And I think about that with my younger students, my female and my male, and students of just that idea of grit and resilience, but also being as true to yourself as possible, so you don't feel like you have to do something to prove yourself to someone else.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's interesting, because I also found even in the sound of your strings, there is this almost metallic clarity. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not the Charlie Hayden-esque warm round, you know, note by note playing, but it's really more steel. It's kind of a steely energy, and that's unusual. That's really unusual. And I have to admit, I needed some time to adjust to this way of making music, and because all the five of you have this energy going, you know, this fabulous husband of yours. And then I was thinking, yeah, in the first piece, because he's from Cuba by origin, so the first piece where he was soloing, that was still kind of audible. You could think of, okay, yeah, there's some clave going maybe and stuff. But then afterwards, it was like totally his own world mixed with whatever he has come across during his training and his perception of music. And then he has this utter strange device, which you have to explain to me, please, in brief terms. He can transform the piano sound in surprising ways, I would say. So he plays piano, and one of a sudden you hear a sound, and that's kind of irritating, because it's like a reverb, or it's something that's changing the twist a bit in the, in the pitch direction. And then in the encore, he was just totally nailing it with a super distorted Rhodesy sound. Is it an electromechanical thing, or does he put any device into the piano? Because it reacts apparently on the way he touches the keys.
So this is many years of Fabian working and trial and error-ing with this process. He's always wanted to make the piano evolve further. And he jokes that he's a wannabe guitarist, in the sense that a guitar, you put, you have pickups on your guitar.
All kinds of effects
Exactly. So he is trying to do a similar thing, but also incorporate it in such a way that it's not, he never wants to have it a bit like to be a gimmick, that it's quite organic, and it's almost like you don't notice it until it's there.
Yeah, it's subcutane, you know, it comes in and you wonder and...
Exactly. So it's many, many years of trial and error of working in different spaces. And I have his old tech writer from years ago, and it was just so many pedals, laptops and everything. And now it's condensed to literally, I think he has two pedals, and he asked for a DI box, and he has pickups, and he knows how to manipulate that. And he's the only person that I know that can do it that well. People do it with mics, which pick up a lot of the drums. But Fabian has managed to have this in such a way that we can play as loud as we want, and he can just really isolate the piano sound.
That's pretty brilliant. Mm-hmm. And so he will need some time to set this up. I mean, it's like a prepared piano 3.0, you know, like really making a new technology out of it.
Yeah, he's actually pretty quick these days. It's many years. I would say probably at least 15, you know, to 18 years of perfecting this. Yeah.
Wow. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Quite impressive. So that was one... your own band, obviously, and you play with many other people in very various settings. And in this situation, you are the leader, and then there are trio situations where I think the three are pretty much like equal. Then there are like Pat Metheny group, where you are following more or less, you know, the compositions of Pat's. Mm-hmm. Again, a kind of a dance between two very different roles, probably. Or is it not that different after all in jazz?
Yeah, I think there are some fundamental similarities of you're always listening, you're always trying to serve the composition the best that you can, and you're always interacting and trying to be accommodating for everyone else. There's always that basic fundamental idea: play with good time, good intonation, good sound, right? And those fundamentals, it's just about sort of customizing the different levels of the other things. For example, how much do I want to play in the foreground or in the background? How much do I want to add to a certain composition rather than play what the written intended line was? Mm-hmm. How much do I want to lead the composition or the direction? So it's just about adjusting those levels and fine-tuning, in my mind, when you're a band leader versus a side person and in different configurations. And that also is affected by the size of the ensemble.
Is there a correlation for you between the size of the ensemble and the amount of space that the people give each other? Mm-hmm. Meaning like the smaller, the more space there might be?
It can be. I really think that that depends on the musicians involved. But I do think that when you've got less people, you've got less minds thinking about, okay, what are we going to do next? So potentially, when you have a smaller group, you can have maybe less instructions and many places to go. So when I'm playing with my group Aventurine with a string quartet and a piano quartet, you've got more people there, and you've also got people with varying abilities to improvise. So there needs to be more instructions.
You know, the string players don't improvise.
They do improvise, but it's not quite the same as a group that I've been playing with for such a long time, you know. So I think, with more musicians, there tends to be more variables, and it's helpful to have a bit more instruction.
Mm. You have this group with, I think it was with Vijay Iyer and Tashan Sori, where you made those two ECM recordings. Mm-hmm. Knowing Manfred Eicher for his aesthetics a bit, I wonder, would he interfere and say, play less, please play less?
Well, Manfred wasn't present for those recordings. So I think we had pretty free rein, I think. But I've definitely been in other situations where he has directed a lot more, yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And how does that change your... Can you embrace that?
I think whenever you have a producer in the studio, it always changes the dynamic. And I think there has to be mutual trust between producers and musicians and cooperation, you know. And that's what life is, you know. And I think we're always going to have varying opinions on what the final goal is. And I think it's sometimes really helpful to have someone who's not a musician to actually have some input. And at the end of the day, we all have to work together, you know. So it's always varied depending on the personalities, the decisions, the music, and the environment.
Mm-hmm. So this is a very beautiful and very diplomatic answer, I'd say.
Yeah, I generally try to be diplomatic because I think there are just so many different ways of thinking of things. And I don't generally feel that there's a hard and fast black and white, yes, this is good, no, this is bad. Mm-hmm. So much is subjective. And the best that you can do is Be as true to yourself as possible and try and let go of your ego as much as possible. So if someone has an opinion on how things should be done, I feel like it's a balance of asking yourself, is that serving the music the best mm-hmm. that it possibly can? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
A minor thing, but it intrigues me, is you've been playing in a garage band when mm-hmm. you were at high school. Mm-hmm. What kind of a band was that? And did they already play your material, or were you just totally serving the garagey aspect of it? And what was the name of the band?
Oh, yeah. So the name of the band was E-Day Fix.
Oh, like...
like the Billy O's idea of having a motif, you know, and except we spelt it instead of the French I-D-E-E-F-I-X-E, we spelt it E-D-A-Y-F-I-X. So we were all music nerds in school.
Okay.
We all played other instruments in orchestra. And then when it was time to play in the garage band, we all switched our instruments and we played Metallica and Rage Against the Machine, Primus, you know, anything that we could sort of let loose on. And it was beautiful looking back. You know, I went home a few months ago and I looked at some of these old lyrics that we would write together. And, you know, I just think that music is such a blessing for especially teenagers, you know, looking back at just even just the things that you go through and how you process them psychologically and how you express yourself. And, you know, some of these lyrics, they're kind of funny, but kind of beautiful at the same time, in the sense that you're still figuring things out, you know.
Sure.
So we used to write together. We used to let loose and improvise, and it was fun.
And it was like a quartet, guitar, bass, drums, another guitar, or what was the setup?
Two guitars, bass, drums, and vocals.
And vocals, separate vocals.
Actually, the vocalist did play guitar as well, so yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you were singing already back then?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that was like the beginning in some ways, and then of course you had all these orchestras and big bands at school. Mm-hmm. You were playing clarinet and bassoon and all this, which I think is important because it informs the way you think about music and about melody and lines, mm-hmm. other than a regular bass player would do, who would, you know, come from the cello or so, which mm-hmm. is of course a very melodic instrument, but it's different. So the role in the orchestra is so different. The idea of writing this complex material, mm-hmm. did this come early to you?
It's hard to say. I remember at a young age, I was trying to make things up. But, you know, in terms of composing more complex material, I think some of it came, perhaps in high school, because I would listen to a lot of bands like Tool and some heavier bands that did actually incorporate a lot of odd time signatures and overlapping polyrhythms, you know, and that was a big influence. You know, even like Led Zeppelin, there were a lot of crazy phrases that are super catchy that you could sing, but are actually, you know, not in 4/4.
Not at all.
Western
it's stripped down
meter.
To like this unit of four musicians. Yeah,
absolutely. So there was that, and then. You know, my sister was listening to all sorts of music from all around the world, which really influenced
my taste. How much older
is
she than you?
She's 5 years older.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But you grew up together, so you could always go and borrow CDs and records.
Absolutely.
And that was more the jazz-oriented material, because like Miles and John Zorn and that stuff.
Yeah, jazz-oriented, but also other world music from Cuba, from other traditions. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
And then getting into, I mean, you've composed for string quartet. Is this something that you learned then at the Manhattan School of Music, you know, orchestrating? Mm. Or is this something that you had been eager trying to do at home even before?
Yes, love.
I want to see the one with the Submarine Reaper.
Oh, okay. Oh, I know. This is not the one. Okay.
Well, the Submarine Reaper blasts and it's so loud.
Okay. All right. This one.
Okay.
So in terms of the string writing, I was always very curious about that. I loved playing an orchestra when I played bassoon. And even in high school, I was playing in a jazz orchestra on bassoon, at the West Australian Academy of Performing Arts, and there would be a woodwind and string section, but we would turn around and there would be a big band. Mm-hmm. And so there were musicians such as Dane Alderson from the Yellow Jackets, was playing bass in Perth at that time, and I was really influenced by them. And so I was always surrounded by a lot of great string players, and I was always interested in that, you know. And I listened to everything, you know, Brahms, Ravel, Debussy, you know. So at Manhattan School of Music, I had more of the opportunity to work with that. I had the opportunity to compose for the Jazz Philharmonic. And I will forever be grateful for this one recording studio near the new school downtown, this beautiful professor, Jim Boniford, who was teaching his students, I think it was maybe SAE or Sound Engineering College, and he would email a whole bunch of musicians saying, okay, anyone want to record anything at my studio? I'm trying to teach my students how to mic acoustic instruments.
Oh, cool.
And it was amazing because we really got to experience that process of recording ourselves, and I would compose and I would write music for string quartet, for double quartet, and we would just go in. I would buy my friends pizza and we'd just go in there, and Jim would be teaching his students how to mic these instruments, and we would play for them and essentially be able to get a recording out of that. And this collaborative element was so important. And I think that's something I say to my students and up-and-coming musicians is if you get that opportunity to collaborate with engineers and budding people who want to learn how to mic instruments, do it, because then we can all learn from the process.
Cool. And of course, you have all these musicians then coming in and playing for you and playing your material.
That's right.
And there's a reason to do it because it's going to be recorded. And
that's
nice.
Yeah,
I guess you maybe are not aware of the fact that you were opening a little series of bassist-led ensembles for this season in the Elbphilharmonie.
Yeah, I wasn't aware of that until last night, and I heard the lineup, incredible, Christian McBride and Lisa Wolf and my absolute hero, Michelle Ndegecello. Yeah.
Yes.
So it's going to be unbelievable. Yeah, what a great program.
Yeah, I was, when I was researching on you, I realized you also grew up with Michelle's music, of course, and she has changed so much over the decades, one must say, and I'm super happy that she's going to come finally, you know.
Absolutely.
We have made several attempts already to have her here, and now I think she's coming with this James Baldwin ensemble she has concocted, and who she's playing with at the Tiny Desk, just as you did recently.
Right. That's right.
It's fabulous, and she also is doing the spoken word and singing and playing bass, which is an art in itself, I find, you know, playing securely and singing totally different lines. So my kudos for that. And then there is this French guy, Henri Texier. Have you heard of his?
No, I'm not quite familiar,
He's one of the old hands of European improvised music, a wonderful, wonderful person. I think he has passed the 80s meanwhile, or is getting close to that. And he has been apparently very influenced by Native American culture, and so he has composed a whole program about Native American music, and so it's quite a wide range.
I love it.
He has a sextet, and his son is playing saxophone in it. And you came, and Lisa Wolf. Have you met Lisa before?
I believe I have. I'm familiar with her work, and she's wonderful. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, local hero, right?
She's the local hero, absolutely. And, you know, she played here in the Grand Hall. I think it was the first jazz concert during the pandemic with her trio. Totally empty Grand Hall. And she was playing and drums, saxophone, bass. That was it. And it was just recorded, you know, for people for some comfort. And now she's coming with her own band and playing seriously. And there is another kind of Hamburg-affiliated musician you will be coming back with next year. I'm speaking about Nils Wulker, the trumpeter.
That's right, yeah.
And that's interesting. And I just want to know, to round that up, our conversation about music and bands, how did this come about? Did he just ring you up, Nils Wulker, who is a very famous trumpet player in Germany and fills halls and everything? And how did that come about?
Yeah, he just contacted me and asked me if I wanted to record with him, and he's got such a beautiful sound, and it was with the wonderful Greg Hutchinson and Aaron Parks, and I love those two musicians dearly. So it was super fun. We recorded in Berlin several months ago. Yeah, so I'm excited. I'm excited to play that music live. Yeah,
he will have a different pianist, if I'm not mistaken. I think it's not going to be Aaron Parks.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I mean, it's great. So, and this is something that you have to decide like way ahead in order to make it possible in your schedule. How well are you booked? I mean,
yeah, basically. So we book quite in advance, and so it's always a bit of a juggle. But I'm grateful. Yeah, it's going to be fun.
So how many nights you would say you perform a year? 100 or out of the 365?
Yeah, I would say that. I would say 100. I think. Yeah. Yeah.
Our third.
Yeah.
Great. Mm-hmm. So I wish you all the luck, of course, and I hope you can, you know, pursue and do this traveling with your husband and with your sweet son through all these venues all over the world. And I hope to see you and hear you again very soon, Linda.
Yeah, thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Das war der Elbphilharmonie Talk, der Gesprächspodcast der Elbphilharmonie mit ausgewählten KünstlerInnen aus unserem Programm. Wenn du keins der Gespräche mehr verpassen willst, abonnier uns doch einfach auf deiner Lieblingsplattform und lass natürlich gern immer eine Bewertung da. Für Tickets und Infos zu den Konzerten in Elbphilharmonie und Leishalle besuche uns auf www.elbphilharmonie.de. Dort findest du in der Mediathek auch weitere Podcast-Formate sowie viele Konzertstreams, Interviews, Hintergrundartikel und spektakuläre Musikvideos.
Elbphilharmonie Talk, der Gesprächspodcast der Elbphilharmonie. Thank you.